Good morning, everybody. Hi, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m., and then Steve Grzanich is here with the opening bell, and Steve Cochran at 6 a.m. With his show. And my dad will call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We'll also play a Blackhawks Express that will probably last 15 minutes. Only 10 goals were scored during the game. So we'll have that for you as well, as much and much more. As you just heard, that is one of the themes to our Monday morning movie reviews. You can follow us at Facebook, at Nick D Show on Twitter, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us right now. We're about to hit 12,000 fans, and it's going to be quite an accomplishment. So do it right now. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us. 312-981-7200 is talk and text. Every week, Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me to talk movies. We weren't on last week because I was filling in for Steve Cochran last Monday morning, so we didn't get a chance to talk about some of the movies that came out last week. But this week, we've got some movies to talk about as well. So you can check out efilmcritic.com. You can check out rogerebert.com and more. And Eric Childress will also talk a little bit about the box office. Interesting story with the box office this week as well. So let's welcome Eric to the show. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hello, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. Now, first of all, we'll get to the box office a little bit later, but we were not on last week to talk about Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. And let's briefly get your thoughts on it. Let's start with Colin. Colin, what'd you think?
Well, I can't say it was a disappointment because I kind of walked in with low expectations. So I guess it met them. I was not a big fan of Man of Steel. Not a big fan of Zack Snyder in general, aside from Dawn of the Dead and The Watchmen. This is pretty much what I kind of expected. It was, it's a 2.5 hour kind of a mess. A friend of mine said Wonder Woman should have been called Wander Woman. She just kind of wanders into the storyline.
Yeah.
It seems to have just been wedged into the film, just really just kind of forced into the narrative almost the last minute, as if they kind of forgot to write her in and just threw her in there randomly. And not a very interesting actress to play her either. So a lot of unanswered questions there. Maybe they'll answer them later in the next film. But it's just kind of free of tension, I'm not sure what audience they're going for with this. I mean, like, I guess, Christopher Nolan going, after the mass audience that loved, the Dark Knight films, but yet this film seems to have been stripped of that, of the intelligence that made those films interesting. It's again, Zack Snyder just ramping up the action so much that it just becomes, just noise and flash. And, again, a lot of just people being needlessly killed so these Titans can fight. And what they're fighting over, I'm still not sure. The Batman and Superman fighting each other. There's so many unclear things in the narrative here. After a while, you just kind of stop caring. There are some visual things that Zack Snyder does that I think is interesting. There are moments in the film that I do like. I think Affleck is good as Batman. He turned out to be okay. There's definitely, a great cast here at work. They're at the hands of a director who, is more interested in showing off shiny toys than really telling a clear story. Not Michael Bay bad, but just in still kind of incompetent.
Okay. Eric?
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same wavelength as Colin. It's funny that he mentions Wonder Woman should be called Wonder Woman. I think she should have been just called Xena in the film, frankly. But this is a film sort of two halves for me. Like, the first hour and a half was me, I was sort of giving the film the benefit of the doubt that I thought, it's it's putting on, it's sort of trying to put on this intellectual cap and whatnot and try to give you this buildup and this reason for these two icons to be fighting each other. And then once they start fighting, I completely lost interest in the film altogether. And I think the film just completely unravels just scene by scene after that and really calls into question so many things that are wrong about the first hour and a half of the movie that I was kind of just giving the benefit of the doubt to. There's been so much that's been written about this film in the week since we haven't talked about it, and all of those write-ups are far more interesting than what is eventually on the screen. I think this Zack Snyder clearly has now, he's shown himself that I think this is a guy that does not like Superman. And I think that's pretty clear now after two movies. I think he has a fundamental misunderstanding of who these characters are and trying to give them some sort of darker arc and trying to be Christopher Nolan. I think he fails pretty tremendously. I've seen worse films this year. I've definitely seen worse superhero movies. But I think it's very clear that if this whole DC franchise wants to go forward, they really have to part ways with Zack Snyder immediately. Otherwise, they're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I hated this movie. I think you guys are being way too kind. I thought this was a disaster of biblical proportions. I hated it. I mean, there was there's so many stupid things in this movie. I'm not going to pick it apart because of logic, because it's a superhero movie. But just even on the basis of levels, simplest of levels, the beginning of this movie, they're showing the destruction of Metropolis, which takes place during Man of Steel. Right. We're whipping each other through buildings and stuff. And so at least they actually, I will give them this. They do actually bring up one of the points that everybody complained about in Man of Steel was like, wait a minute, 40 million casualties took place during the last 20 minutes of that movie. And they do talk about that. But my question is, like, Ben Affleck, the beginning of the movie, and the first, 10 minutes of the movie is a car commercial for a Jeep, essentially. And he's driving around, and I guess he has to call. Who is the guy he's calling?
Some guy that works for Wayne Industries.
But it's like, is it family or some guy that works for him or?
Just works for him.
Okay, just some guy that works for him. All right, so here's the thing. Is it really necessary that Ben Affleck fly down the road desperately trying to call someone who, if all they got to do is look out the window to realize that they need to get the hell out?
At the beginning. Question the fact that if Bruce Wayne knows what's going on and, maybe he wants to show up in the Batmobile.
Yeah, well, you would think that. But I'm watching the movie and I'm thinking to myself, okay, this is your, you are starting out with this logic. The opening scene of this movie makes absolutely no sense, and it just gets dumber from there. I thought it was a train wreck on every possible level. The only thing in this movie that didn't suck was Ben Affleck. There are 8 million dream/fantasy sequences, including one that has probably the most complicated one-take fight sequence shot in the entire movie. That's for naught. Because it didn't happen because he fell asleep at his desk? What? I mean, it's like this 8-minute sequence, this big battle scene where, and then it, like, he's chained up and Superman comes in and takes his mask off. None of that happened. None of it happened. And when the sequence was over, he wakes up at his desk. I'm like, are you kidding me? I sat through 10 minutes of this and it doesn't have any impact on what's happening in the movie at all.
Well, now you know how I felt at the end of Femme Fatale.
Well, but see, Femme Fatale rules.
And me at the end of, Atonement.
And you at the end of what?
Atonement.
Ah, see, now that's another good movie.
Yeah, none of it happened, though.
But, all right, here's the thing.
Yep.
Jesse Eisenberg is embarrassingly bad. Embarrassingly bad in this movie. I don't even know. Gal Gadot? Is that her name?
Godot,
whatever?
Yeah.
Barely makes an impression, okay? The handling of the Superman, if you are a fan of Superman, you really should not see this movie. You're just going to be angry. And I agree with you, Eric. It's clear that Zack Snyder has no idea how to handle the Superman stuff and no idea how to handle the Batman stuff because all he's trying to do is in some pathetic way copy what Nolan did. And not even getting, and I don't even like the Nolan movies, and he's not even getting remotely close to what Nolan failed at. So it's just And it never ended. It went on forever. I was angry when it was over. So, yeah, I think it's one of the worst movies I've seen all year. So, I don't know. And we'll talk about the business, how it dropped. listen to the evil laugh that Eric had there. But now they set up the three characters that are going to be part of the Justice League.
Well, four if you count Wonder Woman.
Right. Well, that's yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you got three more. You got the Flash dude.
Mm-hmm.
You got Conan, the remake guy, as Aquaman.
Yeah.
And then the character I had I had to text you, Eric.
Yeah, and I had to ask my friend who it was.
I was like, "Who's this guy? Should I know who this? I know Joe Morton, but
yeah.
who's the dude tied to the table screaming? What?
T-800 apparently.
Yeah, just keep him away. Keep Joe Morton away from technology,
right?
And any company that has anything to do with robotics in the future.
That's right.
Because we know how that turns out.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Did you know Cyborg, Colin?
What? No, I don't know. I don't know any of this stuff. What?
Yeah, I had no idea. I had no idea. I went with Mike View, and we both, like, afterwards, first of all, we were angry and wanted to punch people in the face because it was so bad. But on top of that, I'm like, and he immediately goes to me, who was the other guy in the thing that was the supposed to be the other guy? And I was like, I don't know. I have no idea. And then finally, Dan explained to me who Cyborg is. And he's like a... He's like a newer, right, addition
to the... Yeah, he wasn't part of the original Big Seven, but he was in Teen Titans and kind of has been graduated up to the Justice
Have you
League.
Seen the movie yet?
I have not seen it
Okay,
yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
You know, the minute my friend told me, I'm like, who is the guy that with Joe Morton? He goes, that's Cyborg. I said, that's a stupid name for a superhero.
Well,
might as well just call him Robot.
All right, well, Batman versus Superman sucks. So there you go. All right, you guys, hang on. We'll come back and we'll review. Oh, this is a good week. That's all I'm going to say. This is a real good week. Hang on a second. Eric and Colin are here, and we are going to talk about the new movies right here on 720 WGN. We got to take a break. We got the news. And then afterwards, the brand new movies, the Monday morning movie reviews continue right here on WGN. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on a Monday morning. My dad will call in and tell a jokey joke. And we're talking about the movies. We got brand new movies to review here. We'll get to the box office with Eric Childress coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and like us on Facebook and be a part of our Facebook page. It's great. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, let's get Eric and Colin back here to review the movies. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
All right, Eric, you are the only one who saw I Saw the Light.
Yeah.
This is very strange because there's two music bios that were released this week, and then next week we've got a third one with the Miles Davis movie.
Right.
So it's like musical biopic
yes.
time here. So tell us about I Saw the Light, Eric.
Okay. Oh, well, this is a biopic about Hank Williams. It was played by Tom Hiddleston in the film. And it's basically, you know, you're sort of your very typical biopic. You know, obviously a very, very famous songwriter and a singer. His wife is played by Elizabeth Olsen, and he tries to get her involved in his act as a duet partner throughout time, but she doesn't quite have the same vocal strength that he does, and that causes some rifts between his management and her, and then eventually streams off into their marriage. But his career continues to flourish, even though he was a very heavy drinker and tended to ruin a lot of the potential roads to a success. And beyond that, there's really not a lot to say about this movie. I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival last year, and while I was watching it, all I could think about was that the people who made this movie, the only biopic movie they had seen was Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, and then tried to make a serious version out of that. And it doesn't nearly have, like, the nuance that that film did and all the complications it had. I mean, it's pretty much, you could do, like, a two-sentence summary of this movie. It's like Hank Williams is a singer.
Hey, can I say something, Eric?
Yeah.
Why hasn't Walk Hard regained the cult and popularity that some of the other comedies of its ilk have. Because Walk Hard is hysterical.
It is.
But you never see it on cable.
No.
People don't quote it or talk about it like they do other films of its ilk.
And Nobody saw it when it came out.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
God, it's so funny. I'm sorry. I just wanted to mention that. If you've
It's better to talk about that than to talk about I Saw the Light. I'll tell you that.
All right.
It's just like sitting through this movie, it's really kind of a slog, and not just sort of a mediocre slog. It's just like you don't really learn anything about Hank Williams except that he sang and he drank. He sang and he drank, and just repeats itself. It has very much sort of the same arc as a lot of your typical biopic movies, but again, doesn't have the kind of the nuance or the performances or the relationships of, say, even something like Walk the Line. And it's just, I mean, by the time it was over and Hank Williams died, sorry, spoiler alert, it just, by the end of it, it's just like, why did I need to see any of that? Like, I remember a couple of these songs, and that's about all I'm going to take away from this movie. This is actually a really quite bad biopic.
Now, how is Hiddleston? Because it seems like, because I happen to be a huge fan of his.
Yeah, me too.
And I think he's great, and it's an interesting choice. It's an odd choice, I think.
Yeah.
But not that I don't think he's capable of doing it. How is he in the movie?
He's as fine as could possibly be as fans that we are of him. He's about the only thing in the movie that keeps your eyes, awake, essentially. I mean, Elizabeth Olsen is kind of in and out of the movie. She doesn't get anything to do. The rest of the cast does kind of just, wanders into the movie here and there and aren't given a whole lot to do. There's, a lot of moments where they have, like, the characters talking like it's a documentary sometimes, like, well, Hank Williams did this, and he had a problem, and then you see that problem, and that kind of stuff. Mm. And like I said, by the time, he crashes his car off screen, you don't really, like, why was I watching this? This is kind of a bad movie.
Okay. All right. That's too bad. Okay. Lost opportunity there, but it's not the only music biopic that we'll be talking about. Let's move on, though. Colin, I don't even know what we're going here with Krisha.
Krisha, yeah.
Yeah, this is, I've not seen this. You guys have. What is Krisha?
Okay, well, this is a film, I saw it about a year ago. I think Eric did, too.
Mm-hmm.
So we're both kind of going on our memories here. So I'll best to do the summarize, my best to summarize it. It's the story of a woman named Krisha who is returning to Thanksgiving dinner with her family for the first time in 10 years. She has kids who have gone on to do well for themselves, but she is an honest-to-goodness train wreck, a complete alcoholic who, try as she might, cannot get her life on track. She has demons, she has addictions, she has a family that wonders if they did the right thing by letting her into their home again. And as you can imagine, it does not go well. So that's your basic storyline. It's an 80-minute film, unknown cast. It's a directorial debut from a guy named Trey Edward Schultz, based on a short film that he made. And we tried to get it last year for the Chicago Critics Film Festival because we really liked it. Didn't happen, but that's another story. It is really a tremendous piece of work from a director whose name we should remember and keep an eye on. It's incredibly, in spite of the simple premise and this and the the one house setting, it doesn't feel like a play. It feels like a piece of cinema. He really calls attention to to himself as a director, behind the camera, doing some fabulous one take shots. And really using music much in the same way P.T. Anderson did with Punch Drunk Love. And it is, you're really in the head of this woman who is played by, and I'm trying to get the name up here, hold on a second.
Krisha Fairchild.
Krisha Fairchild, thank you, mm-hmm. Who is phenomenal in the film. I don't know who she is. I looked up her IMDb. I haven't seen her in anything before this. But she just has this face that opens the film that is just really striking. And so that was my memory of the film, just being kind of blown away by it. I had already seen the short film that it was based on. And this movie worked much better as a feature than it did as a short, which is kind of why I didn't program it a couple of years ago. So this movie has a long history of not being programmed at our film festival. but you should definitely go see it. Unfortunately, it's only playing at one theater. That's the 600 North Michigan.
Which is an odd choice, a very odd choice.
Very odd choice, but the seats are comfortable. You should go and support this film because it's really good.
Okay. That's Krisha. And Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, Colin's memory is not hazy at all. Krisha Fairchild, the main actress, is actually the aunt of the director.
Okay.
Many of the family people playing the family in the movie are actually members of his own immediate family. Just give you a little bit of history about the movie. This movie premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival in 2015, and it was a film that, like Colin mentioned, kind of really blew us away at the time, and we were trying to get it for the festival, and the director really wanted to play our festival, and the only reason it didn't is because it ended up going to Cannes. So someone else obviously thought very much of this movie too, and then A24 eventually picked it up. It was nominated for an Independent Spirit Award last year, I think for Best First Feature or Screenplay, one of those two. And everything Colin said is absolutely on point. I mean, this is it's a feature that a lot of first-time filmmakers try to copy this kind of style, you know, sort of minimal dialogue, train wreck type characters, family settings, and it's really kind of, you know, as far as like nightmare Thanksgiving movies go, this one should rank right at the top. And just, you know, if people want to see a really just horrific Thanksgiving experience, you'd see this movie. It's in many ways not a pleasant film to watch at times, but the pleasure is actually in the filmmaking and in the performances. And when this thing finally does break down in the third act, it's really you're kind of sitting there just kind of stunned and saddened and horrified by everything that ends up happening in this film. It really is one of the best films of the young year.
Wow. All right, so that's called Krisha. And if A24 picked it up, why is it only getting a release at, like, 600 North Michigan? Is there any reason why that happened?
Well, probably just because it's got no cast. I mean, it's not exactly a film that's going to – I mean, A24, you know, while they did release The Witch, other than that and, like, Ex Machina, they haven't really released a lot of their films wide. But you know, when you see the film, I mean, you will see why this would get a very limited release.
Okay. All right, and the short was, did it have the same actress? Was it the same actress in the short?
Same everything, house, same actors. A lot of the same scenes were recreated shot for shot that I barely could tell the difference. So he basically remade his own film, only you know made it better. So.
And did he pad it out? I mean, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, it fleshed it out. The reason why it didn't work as a short is because it definitely called attention to itself as like a really strong new director working behind the camera. But it just, I couldn't think of a good reason to put an audience through this. You know, it's like, wow, this is great to watch cinematically, but I have no idea where to put it. And it just doesn't add up to much of anything. You just kind of left wondering like, what was the point of that, other than to be, you know, great behind the camera and great editing and great performances, but there's just something missing here.
Right.
I almost programmed it, but I just couldn't think of how. And when I saw the feature, I was like, that's why it needs to be a feature. Mm-hmm. It does.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. And that's it's only playing at the 600 North Michigan here downtown, and it's called Krisha. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Eric and Colin here, and we're talking about the new movies on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. We'll do the box office as well. That's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Hey, MyPillow sure has come a long way in the past 11 years. From one man in a small Minnesota garage to now having over 700 employees, MyPillow has helped over 12 million people get the best sleep of their lives. MyPillow is guaranteed the most comfortable pillow that you will ever own. It's the official pillow of the National Sleep Foundation as well. So what's so great about these pillows? Well, they have this patented interlocking fill that conforms to your preferred shape. They even have this built-in cooling effect that keeps your head cool throughout the night. They're not allergenic. They are machine washable, and they're proudly American-made. The best part, there's absolutely no risk in trying one out. Sleep on it. And if you don't think it's the best pillow that you've ever owned, return it within 60 days and get your money back. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code WGN for 50% off all products, or call 800-299-9579. Try it out now, MyPillow.com, or call 800-299-9579 and use promo code WGN. Good morning, everybody. Hi, welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and Steve Cochran at 6. It's Eric Childress and Colin Suter who review movies with me every Monday morning, and we are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. We'll also tell you about the box office. Let's get back to those reviews. All right. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, tell us about Born to be Blue, which is the second. Well, this isn't really a biopic, per se.
It's biopic-ish.
Ish, yeah.
Yeah.
But go ahead, tell everybody about this one.
Okay, well, this one is a music biopic about jazz musician Chet Baker, who was played by Ethan Hawke in the film. As the film opens, it's on the set of a film that Chet Baker is making, or has been cast as himself, to play himself during a period in his life when he first tried heroin. He ends up hooking up with the actress on the set, played by Carmen Ejogo, and on their first date, Chet is actually attacked by a bunch of people that he owes money to, and they knock his teeth out, and that puts him through a period where he essentially has to relearn how to play his instrument all over again. And clearly he's got some demons and has been on heroin and some admits to playing better on heroin. Kind of a sad character, not sort of your atypical biopic about a drug user who just goes off on everyone all the time. He's very, very insulated, very aware of his behavior. But he loves music and he really wants to get back in the good graces of the people that he respects and be a part of this world. So as biopics go, the way this movie sort of begins, it's almost venturing on self-parody at times. The first half hour of the movie that deals with the stuff on the movie set and some sort of questionable ways to have the jazz scenes. It actually reminded me a lot of those Eric Jonrosch things that IFC did, The Spoils of Babylon.
Yeah,
it actually reminded me a lot of, there's a portion of that film that actually had Tobey Maguire in a jazz phase, and it seemed exactly like that. So the first 45 minutes of this movie, I was a little just kind of on edge that I was watching a director who was trying to do something that just wasn't working. But then kind of a remarkable thing happened, and I really started to really pay attention to Ethan Hawke's performance in this movie. And this is one of those movies that has a performance that kind of transcends the material. It's one of those performances that you can't take your eyes off. I think it's one of the best performances of Ethan Hawke's career. And just watching him, particularly in the back half of this movie, particularly in some of the later scenes, I just started forgetting about all of my criticisms, and there are many of them during the film. And it's certainly not a great film, but if you want to see a movie or just want to see a performance rather than a movie, this is one to check out.
Okay. Colin?
Yeah, I liked it a little bit more. I like that this is, part of seems to be a movement going on in spite of the Hank Williams film, to sort of break free of this conventional biopic thing by just picking an isolated moment in an artist's life and concentrating solely on that and letting that tell the bigger picture. And the film, does that, just like Love and Mercy did that last year. I think, this is definitely one of Ethan Hawke's best performances. Maybe it is his best performance. But I really like, I think the relationship between him and Carmen Ejogo is really the soul of the film and really the reason to watch it. I think it's more than just Hawke's performance. I think her performance is really good, too. They make for an interesting kind of tragic couple. So I really enjoyed, you know, seeing that relationship come to life and develop. And, you know, the movie does not give me, I don't know nothing about really Chet Baker's life. I'm learning everything from this film, really. I'm just not a jazz guy. So the movie ends at a place where, you know, it's just kind of knocked me out for a bit. For somebody who doesn't know anything about Chet Baker and for somebody who doesn't really know much about jazz music, you know, if that's you or even if it's not you, I definitely would recommend seeing this film. I think it's really good.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. I do know. Now, you guys then, yeah, you didn't see Let's Get Lost.
No, still haven't.
Okay, documentary. Colin, you've not seen that? Let's Get Lost.
No, I don't think I have.
1989, Bruce Weber directed it. It's a bio. It's a documentary about Chet Baker, and it is phenomenal. If your interest has been piqued, mm-hmm. I highly recommend you watch Let's Get Lost.
Okay.
A great film. Now, I prefer that movie, but this movie is carried, I think, by Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke is amazing in this film. It is easily the best performance he's ever given, and it's a pretty stunning piece of work. I wasn't as crazy about how they told the story. Because I knew the Chet Baker story before, because when I saw Let's Get Lost back in '89, I kind of became obsessed with him because it's such an incredible and strange and compelling story. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I started listening to his music, and I had friends who were way into it at that time back in '89 and '90. And I went through a period where I listened to a lot of Chet Baker, and I read about Chet Baker a lot. I'm not crazy about what they kind of reimagined here. It's not accurate to what really happened, but the spirit of Chet Baker is alive in what Ethan Hawke does in this movie. It is an astounding performance. Is there a chance he's going to get nominated? I know it's a smaller movie. I saw it at my house. I saw it on the on-demand.
Yeah,
I saw it on demand. And I mean, is there any, because he's so good in this movie. Would they get behind this and maybe push him for a nomination? I know it's only April.
I'm sure there will be a push, but it's a movie that could very easily be forgotten.
God, that's too bad.
Yeah.
It's too
early.
Yeah.
I mean, if you release this movie in September, October,
yeah,
you get a few more bites.
I hope so, man. I hope people don't forget about this performance. Like I said, I don't think it's a great movie. I think it's interesting. I wasn't crazy about, you know, them sort of changing things around and reimagining stuff. And if you want to see the definitive sort of story really beautifully done, rent Let's Get Lost. It is a great film. One of the best movies of 1989. Bruce Weber directed it. A tremendous movie. But if you want to watch one of the best performances of the year, without question, Ethan Hawke in Born to Be Blue. He's great. Okay, guys, hang on, all right?
All right.
All right, Colin and Eric are here, and we are reviewing the new movies. We've got a break here for the news, and afterwards we'll jump right back into the movie reviews here on WGN. Morning, everybody. Hi, Nick DiGilio here. Welcome back to the show. 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Monday morning movie reviews are happening right now. We'll have a joke from my dad because it's a jokey time on Monday morning. And we will play a replay of the Black Hawks Express. As I mentioned earlier, it may last an hour and 12 minutes from yesterday's insane game against Boston. So that's all coming up and more. Always stay with us at 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter. Follow us at Nick D Show. But the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. You should like us on our Facebook page. And we're hitting 12,000 fans is cool. And so let's do it. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every week to talk about the movies. And we'll talk about box office with Eric as well. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right. Now, let us say that there were two movies that came out this week that some of the wider releases that neither of us, none of us had gotten to. God's Not Dead 2. Eric, God's Not Dead 2, one of the faith-based films that seemed to be coming out every other week.
Yeah, a sequel to one of the most evil films I've ever seen in my life.
God's Not Dead.
Correct.
Now, what happened in God's Not Dead that they needed 2?
I don't know. Maybe to find out exactly, maybe they resurrect Kevin Sorbo as a zombie or something. I don't know.
Is Kevin Sorbo in it?
In the original, he was.
Oh, man.
He was the teacher that challenges
students. Right. I remember now.
Yeah, and then the one student, you know, challenges him, and then Kevin Sorbo is, like, all evil incarnate, and then he gets hit by a car.
Fantastic. Well, you can't hit Hercules with a car.
Well, they kill him.
You can't kill Hercules.
Christian rock concert.
You can't kill Hercules. I don't buy it.
They did.
No way.
They killed him.
All right. I still maintain that the Lou Ferrigno.
The Rock is Hercules.
No, the Lou Ferrigno two Hercules movies are the greatest. Those are the greatest movies ever made. The fight in
now, Lou Ferrigno in God's Not Dead 2, I would see that.
Oh, sure. In the original Hercules with Lou Ferrigno, I prefer that fight scene with the bear to the Revenant. And if seriously, Colin, you've seen the Hercules movies, right?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, they're fantastic. They're just fantastic. Did I ever tell you? I'll tell you quickly the story. But we watched my friends and I watched Hercules, the Lou Ferrigno, the first Hercules, like 80 million times. We would watch it over and over again and just laugh our asses off. We knew every line of dialogue from it. It just was one of the greatest. It is one of those phenomenal, horrible movies that is unbelievably entertaining. Of course, featured in that wonderful Canon documentary.
Yep.
So they made a sequel, okay, and which we were just like, we couldn't believe it. And I remember it only played in one theater. It opened up, I don't know what year. I want to say it was like 86 or 87, okay? And the original Hercules came out in 83, so they waited like 4 years for the sequel. So they released this sequel, and it was in one theater. It was at the Mercury Theater, which no longer exists, at North Avenue and Harlem, okay? It's not there anymore. I saw a bunch of movies there when I was a kid. I saw The Shining there. I saw Prom Night. Lots of movies of that ilk. So anyway, we go. And my friend, there's like seven of us. We go. Opening night. We're just so excited. We get in there and we're beside ourselves. There's nobody else in the theater. And this was a big theater. You know, I mean, they'd split the theater in two, but it still had like, you know, it was a big enough theater to have like 500 seats in it. So we're in there, we're the only people in there, and we are besides ourselves. We're so excited, we can't wait. And we're laughing, and we're having a good time, and you know, the trailers are, you know, the trailers are about to start, and we're having a good time, and the manager comes in. Manager of the theater comes in. As I mentioned, no one else in the theater, just us, comes in and says, "You boys are being way too loud. You're being way too obnoxious. And we will not show this movie if you continue to behave in this manner."
Did you call yourself the Pinheads?
And I said, yeah, Huey Lewis came in and said that. He had a megaphone, oddly. So the guy says, yeah. And I kind of stand up and I look around and I'm like, "Sir, we're the only people here." He's like, "Well, there people might show up and you can't act this way. You know, you can't be so loud." And I'm like, "No one else is going to come and see this movie. You're lucky we're here, you know." But he admonished us, you know, and he left, and we were like, screw him. And nobody else came in the theater. We had the theater all to ourselves, and we full on riff tracks it, full on. And it was one of the best times ever. But we were, I could not stop laughing when this dude came in and threatened to kick us out. Like,
a guy who has nothing else in his life.
Clearly.
But that little power trip that he gets
by
putting on that uniform.
And you know what else was funny? He comes in and he says that to us. And I didn't say this to him, but I was thinking it. And we talked about it afterwards. That was in the 80s, back when the projection unit, the union was unbelievable. Like projectionists were getting paid like $80 an hour. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, listen, dude, you know, this is 2 hours that you got to pay this guy. That's like 160 bucks right there. And we paid like $5 each to get in. And at least we're chipping away at this guy's salary that you have to pay whether or not we're here. Unbelievable. So that was that was one of my favorite Hercules stories. We were so excited, and it didn't disappoint. Oh, my God, Hercules 2. Magnificent. All right, so God's Not Dead 2. And then the other one is Meet the Blacks. And this is a Mike Epps comedy.
Yeah.
And I saw the trailer for it, which is why I didn't see the movie.
you weren't intrigued the fact that it's actually a parody of The Purge?
No, see, and I didn't even know that from the trailer.
Oh, like, really?
No, well, from the I did not see the full trailer until after I'd seen
the commercial.
I saw a bunch of commercials for it.
Okay.
And I saw like Mike Tyson with a wig on, screaming, and yeah. And Epps is in it, and and who else is in it? I don't even know who else is in it.
I don't know.
I can't remember.
Cat Williams, maybe. I don't know.
He's in prison, I think.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, so
they made this movie.
So I didn't know it was a Purge thing until I saw like a full trailer.
Yeah.
Why is it called Meet the Blacks? Why don't they call it like, you know, like at least when Damon Wayans makes these movies, at least the title is similar to the title of the movie that he's, you know, doing a parody of.
Well, what would you call The Purge, like Black Purge?
The Purging, or I don't know.
The Purging, no, that's not bad.
I don't know.
The Binge.
Yeah.
The Binge, yeah.
The Binge, yeah. So, but no, nobody saw it.
No.
And evidently nobody in the country saw it either.
I've yet to see a Purge film, so I'm guessing the jokes will go over my head.
Lucky man.
You know, they keep showing the trailer for this election year Purge thing. That movie is going to be a piece of crap. You want to talk? Let me explain something. Boy, we're talking about Ethan Hawke in a good way, and then we bring up the Purge.
why go see the movie? Just wait for the real Purge to happen when Trump's president.
Yeah, oh, please don't even think about that. So anyway, Purge. The thing about it is that is a really rich concept for a movie, don't you think?
Yep.
Like, it's a great idea for a movie. And when I saw the first trailer for it, I was like, oh, that's a great idea. One night, every crime, including murder, can be legal. Boy, that's really, you could really do a lot with that premise.
Mm-hmm.
No. They turned it into Assault on Precinct 13, again, featuring Ethan Hawke.
Yep.
but it turned into a bad home invasion movie. And I have a weakness. I happen to like home invasion movies.
Yeah.
But I thought The Purge was terrible. The second one was unbelievable.
Yeah, it's bad too.
Who's the dude who's now like he's the star?
Frank Grillo.
Yeah. Who? Why?
Well, yeah, I don't know.
And now he's in the third one.
Oh, is he?
I think so.
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen I've only seen a teaser. I don't even know if I've even seen that. But who cares?
Anyway, it comes out. Just in case you're wondering, it's their big release on July 4th.
Oh, good.
There you go. Oh, man, that's going to be a rough weekend. That and the damn Independence Day sequel. Oh, man. It'll be a good week to stay in. All right, Eric, Colin, hang on a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Colin here, and we were talking about a couple of the movies that we didn't see, God's Not Dead 2 and Meet the Blacks. But we got a couple more movies to talk about, and in my opinion, two of the best movies of the year that we're going to be talking about. So, morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here until 5. All right. And let's get back to the movie reviews, Eric and Colin. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Now, Eric, I am to understand that you did not see Everybody Wants Some.
That is correct.
Wow.
This is apparently the movie that doesn't want me to see it.
I know you had some issues in Austin.
Yeah. There were two screenings here in Chicago before I even got to Austin. No one told me about those.
Uh-huh.
Then I get down to Austin, and I show up an hour and a half before the movie, the premiere starts, and get in this gigantic line that normally would have been good enough to get me into the theater. And like 20 people in front of me, they like, no, we're not letting anyone else in. Go see something else.
Mm.
So I did.
Okay. All right. And Colin, you have seen it.
Yes, I have.
Okay. Colin, tell us about Everybody Wants Some.
All right. Well, this is the latest from Richard Linklater, and he describes it as a spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused. So this one takes place in the early 80s and is definitely in the spirit of Dazed and Confused and much of other Linklater's films in that it kind of meanders from character to character with just a thread of a through line. In this case, a baseball jock named Jake, who begins his first day of college, 4 days before classes start. He's in a fraternity made up of other baseball players, and they spend their nights going to discos or country bars or other college parties in the area, one of which is put together by a sorority. There's a passing love interest storyline between Jake and another new girl. There's hazing, there's pranks, there's all manner of crude behavior from the jocks who dominate this film, as well as some, you know, typical Linklater-esque musings on subjects like the need for competitiveness and why these guys behave the way they do. So it's a very loose, very free-flowing kind of a film. And it's a movie that I think works better sort of in a vacuum, free of comparison from Dazed and Confused. Once we start comparing it to Dazed and Confused, I think it suffers a little bit in comparison, just by virtue of the fact that I think Dazed offered a much better, much richer array of characters and character types than this film does. It, you know, both male and female. This is a much more male-dominated film. There's really only one female character in the whole thing, whereas I think Dazed and Confused gave us a lot more than that and ends up being a much richer film. And so I think it gets shortchanged. I think a lot of the characters in this film are kind of interchangeable. You know, each one of them has a sort of Linklater-like speech on something about behavior and, you know, and college life. You know, they're basically speaking Linklater's, you know, words for him. Now, all that being said, I'm not down on the film. I do find it very entertaining. I do enjoy the characters that are on the screen. Each of them has, at least one moment to shine. But, and I certainly would, I would definitely, watch this movie repeatedly. I think it's just, in terms of his whole career, I think it's like my eighth favorite Linklater film. And at least that's where it is on my Letterboxd list right now. But I think he's made better films. I think he's done this thing better in the past. But I still recommend the film for his fans, just because I do think it is him doing one of the things that he does very well.
I absolutely love this movie. I absolutely loved it. I think it's a wonderful companion piece to Dazed. You're absolutely right, Colin. It is a much more male-driven movie. It is told from, almost exclusively male point of view, and I don't think that's bad. I agree with you that the female voice is lacking in this film, especially if you're going to compare it to Dazed and Confused. Now, when he calls it a spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused, I think that that's absolutely the best way to describe it, because Dazed and Confused is populated for the most part by teenagers, some of whom are getting into high school and some of whom are leaving high school. And it all takes place in a matter of hours. It just takes place in that one night and that one day. And it has a variety of characters. Now, he specifically goes into a different direction here. And because 1980, there's a big difference between what happened in, the things that happened in 1980 in terms of cultural stuff, in terms of music, in terms of lifestyle that happened in 1980. It's a massive difference between what was happening. It's only 4 years, but it's a huge difference between what was happening in 1976. And he captures August of 1980 perfectly. This movie takes place over the course of over 3 days. Leading up to the actual first day of college. And that structure, I think, is fantastic. It is loose. It meanders just like Dave's did. It meanders just like a lot of Linklater movies do. I think it's beautifully written. I think the cast is phenomenal in this movie. Everybody is great in this movie. And there are going to be some breakout stars because of this movie. And there's no question about it. There are so many, I think, great characters. One of the guys I wanted to mention is a guy named Glenn Powell. Glenn Powell plays Finn in the movie, who has a lot, Colin, of the Linklater speechifying stuff. And I think delivers it beautifully. For those of you who watch Scream Queens, he played Chad on Scream Queens, and he was hilarious. Eric, you watched Scream Queens, right?
Wait, was it Emma Roberts' boyfriend?
Yes.
Oh, that guy's hilarious.
He is hysterical on Scream Queens, and
yes,
he is great in this movie, among many great performances. I thought the characters were wonderful and distinct. I didn't think they were interchangeable at all. I thought they had great great personalities. The girl who plays the lead is Zoe Deutsch. I want to mention that's Leah Thompson's daughter. and Howard Deutsch's daughter, and she's great in it, and it's a wonderful, nice little relationship that they have that I think is sweet and well-written. There are really, I think, heartfelt and beautiful moments sprinkled throughout this entire movie. And I love this movie. I loved every frame of this movie. I guarantee you I will see it a minimum of 9,000 times. And I will be quoting from this movie, I think, as often, you know, now as I quote from Dazed. And I think it's a great film. It's a different kind of movie. And again, Colin, you're absolutely right. Very male driven. But I don't think it's any less insightful. I don't think it's any less delightful. And I don't think it captures the time period in which it's based more perfectly. And so, I mean, you know, in any movie that opens with My Sharona and ends with Let the Good Times Roll by the Cars is all right in my book.
Well, it sort of ends with Let the Good Times Roll. It ends with a rap song.
Yes, it does.
Cast, which I don't need. That's another thing I don't like. I don't like the rap song at the end. I think it's a bit much.
Oh, I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was hysterical. So I don't know. You know, but that's like the post credits thing.
Yeah.
You know, in case you want to stick around and watch it. I say you do because I think it's great. But I loved it. It's for me, it was almost a perfect movie. And I cannot wait to see it again. So real, real strong, high, one of the best movies of the year recommendations from me. So but I kind of knew that. I kind of felt that way going in when I saw it. And I was so excited. I actually went. I haven't gone to a Thursday night, you know, like 9:45 screening of a movie in a very, very long time. But I did, and I was not disappointed. Okay, guys, hang on. We got one more movie to review, and it's Jeff Nichols' new film called Midnight Special. Morning, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studios on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. And it is Monday morning, which means we review movies, and we talk about movies, and that's what we're going to do. We're all going to be talking about the box office as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. And, yeah, we got one more movie to review here, and then Eric and I will talk about box office. And the movie that we are about to review is a new one by a director named Jeff Nichols, and it's called Midnight Special. And, Eric, why don't you tell us about Midnight Special?
Okay, as you mentioned, this is a new film from Jeff Nichols, who gave us Shotgun Stories, Take Shelter, and Mud. As the film opens, there's a young boy who is on the road with two gentlemen, played by Michael Shannon and Joel Edgerton. It appears he's been kidnapped or rescued, we're not exactly sure at the beginning, from a religious group headed by Sam Shepard, who the FBI is interested in for their own purposes. And everyone seems to be after this young boy. Turns out to be Michael Shannon's son. And they are on the road because the boy possesses some special gifts, as you will. And we're not exactly sure what these gifts are, where they came from, how they're manifested. But everyone, you know, particularly the U.S. government, has an interest in him. Joel Edgerton plays an old friend of his that is helping him transport the boy out of harm's way. Kirsten Dunst is Michael Shannon's wife, who pops up during the movie. Adam Driver plays, for lack of a better term, the Charles Martin Smith role in the film, as the empathetic scientist who begins to figure out exactly where everyone is going. And this religious group also has a couple of people on their tail as well, trying to bring the boy back to them to fulfill some prophecy that they believe the boy might have a hand in. So you have a film here that could be basically set a spiritual sequel to Starman, if you will. For the first hour of this movie, I was really, really in love with it. It's a film that is the kind of storytelling that is, you know, two or three steps ahead of the audience. It's making the audience play catch up on exactly what is transpiring here, what exactly is going on with all of these characters, what is this plot really evolving into. And I think Nick Nichols plays this first hour really beautifully, really keeping us on edge. Some really tense, thrilling moments, particularly a moment at a gas station that is done pretty extraordinarily.
And then as the movie went on and sort of got closer to its finishing point, I started to not exactly lose interest in the film, but I was finding myself a little bothered that there was not a few more things being vocalized, particularly with the Joel Edgerton character, who is more or less sort of the eyes and ears of the audience in this story. I think the characterizations of everyone ends up being a little two-dimensional for their own good. And I think ultimately where it leads to is maybe not quite as satisfying as one might hope. I know there are people that are really connecting on this movie on a more emotional level, particularly the fathers who see this movie. I did not exactly connect on it on an emotional level. I connected on just on a storytelling level. I think everyone's good in the film. I just wish there was a little bit more to the actual characters. I wish a few more things were sort of paid off in the last half of this movie as far as a lot of the sort of the spiritual questions and what this boy represents to all of these different people who are connecting to him. I think it's a good film. I think it's a great film for an hour, and I think it ends up being just a good film. Absolutely one worth recommending, particularly this early in the year.
Okay. Colin?
I like the movie a lot more, although I definitely agree there are a lot of things left unexplained. And I think that's the way that's how Nichols works as a storyteller, in that he's not interested too much in getting too bogged down in plot and specifics. And he said this, he's more interested in the thematic elements and what the bigger picture is and what the film is really all about. And in this case, a big part of the film is about parents saying goodbye to their children or letting their children go into, wherever it is they're going to go. And that's kind of the big theme that the film is leading up to, which I found pretty powerful. I do have an advantage in that I've seen the film twice. Going in back in and seeing it a second time, I think it made it that much better. And I like how the film, Eric mentioned the religious cult, which is pretty much the FLDS the Church of Latter-day Saints, that we've seen in Big Love and, many other documentaries, that the film could have used that aspect as a way of, condemning it, which certainly is condemnable. But the movie sidesteps that. It's just a part of the story. It doesn't really have any, Jeff Nichols isn't trying to say anything about it. It's just there, which I think is a really interesting way of bringing spirituality into the story that is sort of spiritual, sort of science fiction, neither here nor there. But the fact that he chose that as a spiritual angle is very, I think, a really interesting choice. A lot of interesting choices in this film. A lot of what he chooses to show and what he chooses not to show, I think it's kind of a fascinating film to watch, in that it is sort of stubbornly opposed to giving you all the facts. And I think if you know Nichols' work going in, that helps. If you're going in completely cold, you don't know, the kind of storyteller that he is, could be very frustrated by it. And I totally understand that. But I think it's a thrilling movie, brilliantly cast. I mean, casting Michael Shannon in that role is also a great choice, because any other actor would totally play up every emotional aspect, especially in the last half hour of it. Yep. And Shannon downplays it very, very beautifully, very effectively. You're still on the journey with him. And I think it's a remarkable performance. So I highly recommend the film.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best movies of the year. You guys know how I feel about Jeff Nichols. I think he's the deal. I mean, this guy is the deal. And his storytelling style is unusual and has never been more challenging than in this movie. And he's made some challenging movies in the past. There's no question about it. And movies that, he's a lot of his stuff is very ambiguous. I think the most straightforward film the guy's made is Mud. Which deals in a little bit of ambiguity, but not, it doesn't like hinge itself on it. You know, there's a very satisfactory sort of climax and ending to that movie. You know what I mean? It's kind of pretty much everything is that you need to know in terms of plot and arc and for characters. It's all explained pretty straightforwardly in Mud. So that's the only movie. But his other two movies, Shotgun Stories, which I still think is one of the greatest directorial debuts I've ever seen, and Take Shelter, which I still think is my favorite of his movies. Because I've only seen, you know, Midnight Special once. But I still think Take Shelter, which ends on a beautiful, haunting, very ambiguous note that I know drove Eric crazy.
Yep.
That I loved, and I know, Colin, you love the ending.
Yep.
This movie has very similar stuff, not just the ending, but in scenes. Like, there are scenes in this movie where stuff happens and it ends, you go, okay. And this happens throughout the entire film, and the structure of it is very interesting. I too thought Shannon was extraordinary. I thought Joel Edgerton was amazing in it too. Kirsten Dunst was really wonderful. Adam Driver is a really great character to play in this movie, and provides some of the few laughs in the film, because it's not a very funny movie. But he's got a couple of funny moments in the movie, and I think the byplay between Shannon and Edgerton is wonderful. And this kid is phenomenal, this Jaden Lieberer. He's great in it, and the stuff between him and Shannon is great. And I was deeply moved by the ending of this movie. Very, very deeply moved. And yes, Eric, it feels a lot like Starman. There's, you know, hey, these coordinates in the middle of the desert, we got to, you know.
I know where they're going.
Yeah, I totally understand that. But this is a movie that works on a lot of levels. It's a challenging film. The audience I saw it with, I think, were completely, utterly baffled by it. And I don't blame them. There are still mysteries within it that I want to discover when I see it again, and I will see it again. I think it's exciting. I think it's interesting. I think it's challenging. It's intelligent, and it's deeply, deeply moving on several levels. It's a movie that is rich with payoff, and I think that Jeff Nichols, judging by the four films that he's made, I think he is, like, without question, one of the best American filmmakers working today, one of the most interesting, one of the most intelligent, and one of the most challenging. And I loved this movie. I think it's one of the best movies of the year. For me, this and Everybody Wants Some, these are movies that, I know it's only April, but these are movies that I don't see not being in my top five when the end of the year comes. So, all right. Colin, we're going to let you go. Eric, we're going to talk box office. What do we got next week?
Next week, well, we got another musical biopic, as you mentioned.
Yes.
We have Miles Ahead, Don Cheadle's Miles Davis film.
Mm-hmm.
We have The Boss with Melissa McCarthy, Demolition with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Boy, that looks good.
I've seen it.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. I don't know. You know, I mean, the trailer looks good, and I like I like the Gyllenhaal. It looks pretty interesting to me.
And Hardcore Henry.
Oh, God. you know what? I can barely make it through the trailer of that movie.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, man. I don't know how I'm going to make 90 minutes of that.
You have motion sickness issues?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. All right, Colin, thanks, man.
All righty.
We'll talk to you next week.
All righty. Bye-bye.
All right, there's Colin. And Eric, you hang on. When we come back, after we take a break here, we will talk about the box office, okay?
Okay.
All right, Eric Childress is here. We're going to do the box office. He writes about it, and we'll tell you how you can read about it and hear about it as well. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Yeah. Did the movie reviews. Now it's time for the box office. Every week, Eric Childress writes up a really great box office analysis, and we love to talk about it. You can read it at movies.com. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. The big story, number one movie in the country, not a big surprise, is Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice, but it dropped a massive amount. What was the percentage that it dropped?
68.4%.
68.4%. Now, you called this, right?
I'm when we talked last Monday, when you were filling in for Cochran,
yeah.
I said the movie, I didn't think it was going to do $50 million. This weekend, and most people had it above 60.
Okay, and it made 50. It made 52.
52. Well, then that's just the Sunday estimates. I promise you that number is going to go down on Monday.
Okay. All right. And that is a huge drop in terms of drops in history. Where does it rank?
Well, it's the fifth since 2002. It's the fifth highest drop for a film to open on more than 4,000 screens. So all your big blockbusters that get these big launches, it's the fifth highest drop. The sixth highest, by the way, is Man of Steel. So the company it keeps, the films that actually had bigger drops were the final Harry Potter film,
two of the Twilight movies, and X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Okay.
Okay. Those are the only four movies ahead of it. And if this movie drops to, say, about $51 million, it'll be the third highest drop ever.
Wow. Okay. So what does that say? That the word of mouth just killed it, right?
Yeah. Word of mouth killed it because, I mean, it's just the fans who wanted to see this movie went, you know, opening weekend. They went Thursday night. They went Friday when the thing opened. And the word of mouth in this thing, you know, not just from critics, but also from the fans who saw the movie, kept people who normally don't, you know, jump at, you know, every single movie that comes out, you know, the people that have to be goaded into seeing something, you know, the people that, you know, like her, like, well, The Avengers is really good. Oh, maybe I'll go check that out. And then that movie makes $600 million. But with this one, and, you know, I said it on your show before, is that DC, you know, even though they're probably going to make a profit on this movie eventually, it has to make $800 million worldwide, and it's like $682 million
That isn't amazing.
Right now. So it's still a lot of money, and it's probably going to end up passing Zootopia and Deadpool worldwide pretty soon. So it's going to make a lot of money, but are people going to want to see a Justice League movie now helmed by Zack Snyder? Because now they kind of know what they're getting into.
Right, yeah. And speaking of Zootopia, number two this week, making $20 million. Boy, this thing is a certified smash.
Monster. Yeah,
wow.
It's an absolute monster. It's doing tremendous business here in the U.S. It's it's over to about almost $276 million in the U.S. right now. No signs of slowing down. It still has another week before The Jungle Book comes out.
Right.
And I don't even know how well that's going to do in the U.S. And it's done. I think it's over $750 million worldwide as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a tremendous hit.
Good. And it's one of those movies that when you hear it's making a ton of money, you go, well, good, because it should.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, number three, My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, which made $11 million, $36 million in 2 weeks. Considered a failure?
No, I mean, only considered a failure if you're going to put it up to the lofty comparisons of the original.
Right.
Which it was never going to hit. I mean, this movie makes $50 million, they'll be very happy, and it seems it's going to do that pretty easily.
Okay. We mentioned earlier God's Not Dead 2 with $8.1 million. Is that less than the original God's Not Dead made?
It is, and this one opened on opened on 2,300 theaters and did $8.1 million. The original only opened on 780 theaters and did $9.2 million.
Ooh, okay. So that's a big drop-off, too. And then let's just Meet the Blacks was the other new movie, and that opened up with just $4 million.
Yeah,
boy, that's a big stinking bomb, right?
Yeah, it probably didn't cost anything that movie.
Okay,
you know, I mean, $4 million is probably more than a lot of people thought it was going to make because it only opened on 1,000 screens.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. I thought it opened wider than that.
Yeah, no. So I mean, that's actually not terrible. I mean, it's not a lot of money, but it's not terrible.
Okay. All right. Now, I wanted to get to this one because it comes in at number 7, 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah.
You and I were texting back and forth, and you said, hey, I'm about to see 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah.
$4.7 million this week, bringing its total up to almost $64 million. What'd you think?
Good.
Yeah.
Solid film. When it was all over, I mean, I liked the film all the way through, and the thing that I thought of at the end of it was just so many, like, how many like horror movies do we see per year now, and you know, that get released or go on VOD that would have a premise like this and would just be completely botched because it's like half of them would be done found footage, or you know, it would be done, you know, or maybe they'd go, you know, a torture porn kind of route. You know, this is just like good old fashioned Twilight Zone storytelling.
Yep.
You know, all the way with a terrific payoff at the end. The performances are really good. The score is really good.
It is a great score. It's
really
a great score
in this movie. It really has you going from the beginning.
Yeah.
Goodman's terrific. Winstead is really good in the film.
Yep. And the other guy is good too.
Legitimately, just solid science fiction film.
It is. And John Goodman is a national treasure.
Absolutely.
He is just a man. He's so good in it. And I really think it's a well-made movie. Very suspenseful stuff. There's some scary stuff, especially involving crawling through air vents.
Isn't that great?
It was fantastic.
It reminded me of Aliens.
Yeah, absolutely.
But,
yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I'm glad you got to see it. That's a good movie and a solid hit.
Yeah, no, very solid hit. I mean, it's going to probably come up short of the original Cloverfield, which made $80 million.
Right.
But this one has kind of steadily made its money, and it's, again, a small budget. Thing's going to make $70 million. That's a huge hit for Paramount.
I can tell you this. My dad has not stopped talking about it since we saw it when it opened. My dad went nuts over this movie and will stop everybody at Jewel and tell them, you got to see this John Goodman movie. So Batman, Superman, number one again next week?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think it's actually going to be beaten by the Melissa McCarthy movie.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what happens.
I think this movie's going to drop off at least another 50%. So that's going to be probably somewhere hovering around 24, 25 million, maybe less.
So you think the boss is going to beat it?
I think so.
Okay. Well, we'll see about that next week. All right, Eric. Thanks, buddy.
Sure thing.
Take care. You can read his box office analysis at movies.com, read the reviews at efilmcritic.com and rogerebert.com, or you can also read Colin and hear them every week on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Okay, we got a break here for the news coming up next here on 720 WGN.